Yeah, I know, you know, we have some really frank conversations in the team about, you know, what it looks like if we have to enter a period of degrowth, you know. Not that we're particularly growth minded or like business, but like, you know, what happens if we do less volume and just because the only stuff left for us is the really top quality and there's less of it. Even if the coffee was not very good, even if the coffee didn't taste well or it had aged, the value of that coffee would have gone up so much, you would make a killing. And that's quite an interesting, that's also kind of like a strange and perverse reality, that coffee's value has gone up so much that all coffee, regardless of quality, is worth a lot more than it was a year ago.
Did you feel ever the urge to write a coffee book?
Now, it is the will of every single British English person to write a book, I think. But to be honest, no, I think I still think I'm not well enough informed. I don't have, you know, I also think you should add something to a space. If you're going to come into a space and do something, you should try to add something. And if you've got nothing new to add, doesn't mean you shouldn't speak, but it doesn't necessarily mean you should try to command the room or something.
This is Stuart Ritson from Osito Coffee, a specialty green coffee importer. And if you talk to him, you need to be awake. Stuart speaks calmly, focused, yet what he shares is loaded with experience. He has experience as a barista, in brown coffee sales, in green coffee sales, as a coffee person and as a deeply reflective human being. I've been following Stuart and Osito on social media for quite some time. Their content struck me. It's open, it's honest, it's valuable, there's no attitude and nothing is staged. That way of communicating also reflects the way they work at Osito, and it comes across in this conversation too. Stuart and I talked about the big shift happening in coffee right now. Which shift, you might ask, because there are plenty. Good question. So is it tariffs, is it prices, or is it local markets? Brazil, India, Mexico, keeping the best coffees for themselves. We recorded this podcast back in June, when the world already felt different. You will notice it when we talk about tariffs. These days, one tweet can change everything. Meanwhile, Brazil was suddenly hit with high coffee taxes that may vanish again tomorrow. Yes, there is volatility, and that is the new coffee world order. But what else defines it? Let's find out together. This is the Kaffeemacher podcast. My name is Philip. Glad you are here. Stuart Ritson, who is he?
Yeah, well, hi, my name is Stuart Ritson. I do a few different things, but primarily I am the director of Osito Coffee here in Europe and the UK. I'm based out of Groningen in the Netherlands, where I've been living for the last 5 years almost. I'm originally British, English, and that's when I got started with coffee during my university times, working as a barista, and then I worked briefly for a tea company, doing all sorts of things there. Which helped introduce me to some people, roasting in London, and oh, I'm skipping over something. I also ran a cafe for Monocle Cafe in London. I was the first manager there, pretty inept. I knew how to make coffee and no one else did. And that apparently qualified me to be the cafe manager. But yeah, and then I worked with Workshop Coffee in London for about 3-4 years as a sales manager there, back in a time when there wasn't really anyone doing that kind of work. I mean, there were big companies, you know, your UCCs and your Bewleys and bigger brands. I'm sure Chivo and people like that had sales reps and people going around countries looking for cafes and helping them build their systems and train their staff. But for specialty, that was relatively new. So I worked in London during that time and then moved to Germany to work with Cafe Imports, which was the first time I was working specifically with green coffee. And that's now, yeah, about 9 years ago. So yeah, had a bit of a personal break after a few years. And in that time, Osito found me and I found Osito, whichever way we want to see it. And I started the office here in Europe and was building that out. So at one stage, I was doing everything from the samples to the invoices to the releases, like literally everything. Now there's a small team around me. And alongside that, I, from that time when I was kind of looking for work and between jobs, I also started a roasting project called Untitled Coffee, which I still do a little bit of, and some consultancy work. So working with different roasters, cafes, and other brands to do specific projects or to do market research. I've done all sorts of bits and pieces. And so I do all of these things.
I would consider this quite a classical coffee career. I mean, did you did you finish your studies?
Yes.
Oh, congratulations, because most people that actually follow this classical coffee career, most people I know, they didn't finish their studies. So but during uni, you started working in coffee as a barista and then in coffee shops, in roasteries and sales. And now it's green coffee sales. And you said Osito found you, or you found Osito. What's the general idea or vision of Osito?
Yeah, so Osito is still quite a small importer and exporter, and that's kind of the crux of what we've been doing from the beginning is export import. It was founded by Kyle Bellinger and Jose Losada, and they knew each other in a supplier-supplyee setting. So Kyle was roasting at the time on the east coast of the States, and Jose was he was a farmer. He still is a farmer, but that really doesn't take up much of his time anymore. They met on a trip to Colombia and headed off, and Kyle really loved the coffee, so he was buying the coffees and roasting them. And then at some point, Jose reached out to Kyle and asked if he would be interested in investing in his farm, which is obviously quite a big thing, especially for someone who didn't even speak Spanish at the time. I always often wonder how that conversation went, like who was the intermediary. But anyway, Kyle did end up investing in the farm, and then they had the whole sort of supply chain. Well, they had the start and the end of the supply chain, but they had nothing in the middle. Osito was kind of born out of that. So, you know, to tie together these two businesses and to look to do this this kind of work in a more relational way than maybe other people were doing. I think there's a lot of great people in this part of the industry these days. But what sets Osito apart is, yeah, we were founded by a farmer and a roaster. And I think that kind of emphasis on having the supply chain fully represented really sets us apart a little bit. So for instance, in the beginning, they were trying to decide how to do work in Colombia to buy coffee and how that we would want to do that. And the key question was, Jose, how would you want your coffees to be bought and sold? And so the small but fundamental difference to other exporters that we have in Colombia is that we have fixed prices. So depending on the coffee quality and the variety, typically these days. So we have kind of three tiers of pricing for regular traditional varieties, you might call them Cultura Castillo and Colombia, for Pink Bourbon, and then for Geisha, and then we have different scores and then different prices, and we keep those prices steady for as long as possible. And this, it sounds small, but for most producers who they're looking to sell their coffee, the price changes on a daily basis depending on the stock market. And so I often put it to people, like, imagine if you know, this is your payday for the year, you're going to deliver all your coffee or half your coffee or whatever it is. You really want to make sure you are picking the right day, you're getting your money's worth. And so you might well cancel a personal engagement, a child's birthday, a party you're planning to attend. You might pay a higher fee for some transport that is hard to get because you need to deliver on a specific day at a specific time in order to try to secure what you think will be a good deal, but you actually don't really know if you're too early in a cycle of pricing. You know, like, the price will go up in a week and keep going up, and a month from now you could have waited a month. Anyway, all that to say, the instability of being a farmer is inherent in producing an organic product and then is compounded by the nature of how we buy and sell commodities. And so we're trying to cut that level of inconsistency and uncertainty down to a minimum. So we work with less producers than some of our exporters, but we're working consistently with those people and offering prices very consistently. I mean, there was years where we had the same price. And so that's fundamentally quite different. And that, you know, in the beginning, Osito was, I don't want to spend too long talking about it, of course, but Osito was Colombia focused, but then clients started asking for our origins, what we did and do in Colombia informs what we do in other places. So we have a member of staff on the ground in Brazil, where we're working a lot in Espírito Santo. We have a consulting partner in Ethiopia. But then we're also buying coffees from some great people in Burundi, in Mexico, I think I mentioned, and India. We just started working in Uganda. We're typically looking for great coffee with a great story. A lot of the team have been working with coffee for 10 plus years. And so we're a little bit more old school with some of our mentality and our mindset. And that means that we actually do kind of believe coffee can have a positive influence on the world if it's done right. And we're inspired to, you know, do deeper levels of transparency or things like that. That's what excites us as a team.
This comes across your communication as well, because this is also one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you. I mean, I've been following Osito for quite some time on Instagram, and the way you described it, how you communicate, and I didn't know the origin story of Osito, but it doesn't surprise me that there was a farmer involved, because the way you communicate and all the information, how they come across, it's very balanced and it's very unique in a way that it's not only for roasters, it's for anyone, and it's also for producers, so everyone can learn its share. And I really appreciate and find it really unique, this type of communication.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, yeah, I do think over the last 15 years, so 12, 15 years working with coffee, I've seen a lack of information go to a huge amount of information. I mean, there were barely any books on coffee. I can hold one up now, like, you know, original Scott Rao, brewing techniques and stuff. Like, there was barely anything.
Did you feel ever the urge to write a coffee book?
Now, it is the will of every single British English person to write a book, I think. But to be honest, no. I think I still think I'm not well enough informed. I don't have, I also think you should add something to a space. If you're going to come into a space and do something, you should try to add something. And if you've got nothing new to add, doesn't mean you shouldn't speak, but it doesn't necessarily mean you should try to command the room or something. And I think there's my way smarter, way more engaged people than I am to do that kind of stuff. So actually, no, I don't know what I would write a book about.
Well, we can listen to you. You maybe don't have to write a book, but you can talk on a podcast. Hey, Stuart, the other day we were talking about green coffee sales, that it only has become tougher to sell or easier. Because if we look back to the past 6 months, I say everything before November 11, 2024, the world was a different place. So the coffee, it was the old world coffee order. And then beginning of November 2024, things have changed rapidly, and they still are. In terms of green sales, has it become easier or tougher?
Yeah, it's a great question. So obviously, your listeners know all about how the coffee price has gone up a lot in that time period you're talking about, the last 6 months, 7-8 months. It has changed, and I think it will keep changing. But you saw definitely at the beginning a fear of these new prices and a disbelief that the price would be so high, and that like people think, oh well, it's like this for a week, it's like this for a month, and then we will wait. So I spoke to some quite significant scale buyers who were just holding out. You know, they're just like, well, we'll wait, we'll see what happens. And in that time, well, actually what you saw was a kind of polarity. A lot of buyers deciding, both on the specialty and on the larger commercial side, we'll hold out. You know, we have stocks, we can wait. We'll just see when the price comes down. Other people saying, this is only going to get worse. Like, this is only going to get higher. This is only going to get more extreme. You know, to such the extent that we booked some coffees when the market was 250, you know, which is a relatively high price, historically speaking. And those coffees were a complete bargain. If you booked coffees at $3, it's still, you know, you're way ahead of other people. So I saw kind of both, and I still see a degree of that. We work with some people who have everything sewn up and sorted out in regards to their coffees for a year or multiple years even. And those people don't seem as stressed because they have plans in place. And then there's other people who, yeah, if they see coffee is affordable, they will just buy it. So it's created quite an interesting situation. I think in general, we're in a place where people are unsure what value is anymore. And that creates uncertainty and confusion, which probably drives people to do less. But we're finding there's lots of specialty buyers still buying, and businesses isn't slowing down for us, at least. But I would say as a whole, probably the industry is slowing down, just because consumption will probably be tailing off, and with the higher prices and things like that. But yeah, the confusion is definitely an issue. Like, if you don't know if 10 euro a kilo is a good price, or 15 euro a kilo is a good price, or 20 euro a kilo is a good price for the given quality we're talking about, yeah, you end up with a really strange world where I genuinely have conversations with one person who says, wow, this is a fantastic coffee, and I can't believe you're able to offer it at this price. And you turn around and there's someone else who says, this is a nice coffee, but it is exorbitantly priced.
So we you're never referring to this. The monetary value.
But yeah. And also, like, you know, monetary value and quality are always connected, and story. But to a degree, I mean, if you could go back in time and buy a huge amount of coffee a year ago and sit on it, even if the coffee was not very good, even if the coffee didn't taste well or it had aged, the value of that coffee would have gone up so much, you would make a killing. And that's quite an interesting, that's what's kind of like a strange and perverse reality, that coffee's value has gone up so much that all coffee, regardless of quality, is worth a lot more than it was a year ago.
Speaking of quality, do you still receive the same quality or better quality or kind of the same quality as the years before?
That's a great question. I think as Oceto, specifically with the way we work, which is working 9 times out of 10 with the same people year after year. You know, we call Philip every year, you know, whatever it is, you see more consistency, I would say. People we're working with, the producers we work with, know what we expect in terms of quality and what we hope for. And a lot of those people are actually, they're driven by their own dignity and self-respect to produce high quality coffee. And I think if the market was really low or the market was really high, they would be producing very good coffee regardless. But that's definitely not the case overall. And we do experience this as well. It's not like, oh, we're great, everything's perfect. It's like, if we see this as well, the market incentives are not there to produce good coffee anymore. So we saw this a few years ago with Ethiopia, and we're seeing it again a little bit. Well, we had some phenomenal Ethiopian coffees this year. We also had some lots that have been a little bit more disappointing. They're still great coffees, but like relative to other years, you see the quality difference. And we saw this, yeah, like a few years ago when the cherry price was very high in Ethiopia, as it has been again this last year, the amount of money the farmers get for delivering their cherry is higher than it normally is. So if the price is good, the people will just deliver whatever they can deliver. They're less discerning with regards to red cherry picking. They're less discerning with waiting to see that their coffee trees are fully ripe, like the cherries are fully ripe, and they won't do as many passes on the tree. They just, you know, they're focused more on, okay, this is a good price. Maybe this good price will go away. So let's pick what we can, deliver what we can, get what we can. And I feel like semi-Quakers is a thing that the industry is a lot more focused on in the last year. It's a bit of a controversial topic, but like at least less ripe coffee theoretically tastes worse. And I would say we're probably seeing more less ripe coffee delivered, and not just in Ethiopia, but I would say across the board. And I often put this to people. You know, if you go into a cafe and you can buy a terrible coffee for €1 or a great coffee for €4, maybe, you know, the barista, there's an incentive to do the €4 coffee. It's like a big difference. But if every coffee in the cafe costs €10, like they can charge you €10 for it, then there will be some cafes that just serve garbage coffee for €10 because it's cheaper. And so you see this same thing, like if the producer gets a good price, no matter what they do, there's not much incentive for them to do good work. An extreme example of this might be in Brazil. We've seen that some farms are actively stripping green cherry, unripe cherry, to process today and deliver as quickly as possible to secure the prices of today. And you think, okay, yeah, that's crazy. And even if they get a negative differential, even if they get a low price relative to the market, it will still be a great price. So I do think we're seeing less availability of like certain qualities. I think the 80 to 84, 85 point, that kind of lower good specialty, that's probably the area that's going to suffer the most.
So we are entering a new coffee world order. I mean, one thing is quality that is well attached to price. But then there's tariffs, there's EUDR, there are new regulations, and there is things we don't know what's going to happen in the next 24 hours coastline. And all of them, they will be reshaping the industry. And you told me, well, more than people realize. Why did you say this?
Yeah. When we were speaking about that, I just think, I think that as supply chains get damaged, there will be, I mean, supply chains are inevitably people based. You know, people always think of like container ships and containers, but ultimately there's people at the one end and the other end. And those people are striking deals and they're based on relationships. And as things get harder to maintain, so that can be like tariffs, that can be the EUDR thing, which is huge. People will lose interest in doing business with certain other people. This is very broad brush, but you know, Indian coffee is on the face of it, maybe going to face 26%. I think it's 26% tariff in the US. And like we as a business had lined up some purchasing. And unfortunately, we're not going to do all of that. We're going to do as much of it as we can, but we can't do all of it because we know that the roasters at the other end will not pay the prices that they need to secure those coffees. And that's also understandable. I mean, people have to run a business. They have to be able to buy products that they can sell at a profit to stay in business. So there's no judgment, but it does inevitably cause these things where like, so maybe the Indian producer goes somewhere else. You know, maybe they go to Europe, maybe they go to Asia. And in the same way with the EUDR, I think there's some countries where they're investing a lot in EUDR. You know, Brazil is doing a great job of getting as much land as possible, like monitored, measured. They already had lots of stuff in place with regards to environmental law. But some countries, I mean, we work in Burundi, and I think we will be offering Burundi coffees in Europe next year. But I would be surprised if the vast majority of Burundi exporters want to send as much coffee to Europe as they did this year or the year before or the years before. Because you think about, like, a single lot might have 5,000 producers in it. So the incentives to falsify data lie just, you know, are very high. And the penalties for EUDR are really high to get it wrong. So then there's a risk there. So maybe also importers say, we don't want to work with these countries that have higher risk or that maybe might be disincentivized from doing this in the most, you know, up to code way. So then, yeah, if I was sat in a place like Burundi or, I don't know, somewhere, a country with lots of smallholder farmers, and I was on the coffee board or something, I would not be saying, let's spend millions and millions to make sure all of these farms are properly mapped, to find out some of them don't even qualify anyway for EUDR. I'd probably be saying, what can we do to attract buyers in markets where these rules aren't in place, where we can secure new relationships, which will be easy, which will cost less? Like, you know, what does it cost to go to Asia and meet a bunch of significant buyers at a show? Or I don't know, like, maybe I'm too skeptical, but I see that there's a very real world where certain coffees are a lot less available and possibly not available at all in certain markets 12 months from now because of the tariffs, because of the EUDR.
Yes, and there's a very real world coffee world that is growing, and it's not in Europe.
Exactly.
I mean, all the coffee markets are growing, but not in Europe. So you told me that you would say we're moving into a phase where there are suddenly two commodities. So the same coffee would be classified as two commodities. One is EUDR compliant and the other one is non-EUDR compliant. So we split them out.
Yeah, in a way. I think, you know, Europe is still the biggest consuming market for coffee in the world. We're going to keep drinking coffee. That's not going to change. But if we have these hard rules, and don't get me wrong, I think it's great that we're trying to deal with some of these problems. And I think hard legislation is actually one of the few things that the European Union, it frustrates a lot of people, myself included. But I think actually it's probably a good thing. Like, too few governments, too few political institutions have teeth anymore. Like, everyone just does what's easy, what makes people happy, and still somehow it's always a mess. But anyway, that's a whole different podcast. I would say, like, yeah, there is so much interest in other parts of the world for good coffee, and EUDR is not going to help. Europe is the biggest consuming market, and we're going to need coffee. It's going to need to be compliant to these rules. These rules are very stringent, in at least that the penalties for them are very high. You know, we're talking like percentages of revenue for companies. And when you're talking about importers, exporters, especially at the commercial end, the actual margin revenue for these companies is incredibly small. You know, like, some of these traders will be doing billions of dollars of business and making, you know, 1 cent per pound on every trade. And it's about volume. But of course, if you say 4% of your whole revenue could be penalized, it's almost better to not do business anywhere that could expose you to that risk. That is too high a risk for those people in that segment of this industry. It's too high a risk. So anyway, all this to say, this means that there will be a lot less coffee, I think, that will be compliant. And then, yeah, you have two tiers. You have, like, it's the same. Like, you have it now to a degree. You can buy the same coffee that has a FTO stamp and without, and the price is different. But I think sort of like UDR cleared, customs cleared, available, Bremen, Antwerp, whatever it is, I would imagine we'll have a huge price difference with, say, a New York or whatever it is, a Houston, or, you know, these coffees, depending on where they are and if they've cleared this standard or not, I think it will have a big difference in the price. But you can't say the same Arabica coffee is worth the same when there's so much different legislation that goes into one versus the other. Like, it's just not going to happen. And I think this is going to be really weird for the commodities market, for sure.
It will be weird for the commodities market, not for the end consumer market, because no one is willing to pay for complying coffee, because compliance is what I expect as a consumer, and it's not my task as a private user to deal with compliance. You told me that you think that East African countries are least prepared, but are really important for certain markets. To what countries did you point at?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to point, makes it sound like I'm pointing fingers, like people aren't doing their job. Mm. I just think like it's fairly transparent where the hardest places are to meet these standards. So to give, I'm sure some of your listeners know about this, but like the EUDR standards basically mean you have to measure the farm, you have to provide basically a map, it's a polygon or a data point of where your farm is if it's too small to have like a plot, and then they look at satellite photography and say, has there been deforestation in the last X number of years? And there's a lot of smart technology around trying to do this with AI, very buzz at the moment, buzzword, but yeah, I, you know, if you have a large estate in, say, Brazil, or yeah, who knows where, there's lots of places, large estates, you probably have a little bit of money you can invest to have your land properly measured. You can also do smart things. You know, this corner of the land wasn't properly kept and it's been deforested or something, so you exclude it from your data. You know, you can do a lot with, if you have resources, you can do a lot. You can be prepared. And so those people will be prepared. But if you're a smallhold farmer in East Africa, you know, or Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, Timor Leste, these kind of places where typically a lot of coffee, and that's like a selection of coffee that's been put together by different people, will have a lot of farmers involved. And to make sure all of those farmers are compliant to a rule they probably don't really know that much about. I mean, most roasters I speak to in Europe don't know a huge amount about this legislation. So how do you expect, you know, someone who's had a family farm for the last 100 years producing the same product, blah, 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 to know that if they cut down these trees in the corner of their land because they want to build, like, maybe a new drying table, or who knows why, that makes them disqualified for selling into Europe. And I just think, yeah, it where there are more smallholder farmers, this will be a bigger issue. And that those are places like Ethiopia, Burundi, Rwanda, and like Indonesia, places like that.
So for this new coffee world order, we talked about price and tariffs, EUDR, but he also thought, well, taste will change. Also because supply chains will change. And you were referring to taste preferences in North America and Europe, Australia.
Yeah.
How do people drink coffee outside of Europe? I mean, you, Osito is, when you source coffee from many places, but it started in the US.
Yeah.
If you compare the American coffee taste preferences to European ones, how do they differ?
It's a good question. I mean, when you look at some, like a company like Osito, I think a lot of our buyers, a lot of our partners are buying similar coffees. And that's more of like, people who like heavy metal music in Finland, and they like it in Seattle, and they like it in, you know, Bogota, and they, you know, it's more of a taste thing.
Yeah, but apparently there's a big metal scene in Finland, but there's also a big
huge
tango scene, which I don't know where it comes from. It must be from a movie.
That's new to me. I'll have to check it out next time I'm there.
Please do so.
But I think there is difference in taste preference. Like, I mean, West Coast US has always been known for like low acidity. Indonesia's wet hulls is like a big thing there. Mexican coffee in the US is very popular, because I think there's a lot of Mexican nationals who are proud of those coffees, and rightly should be. But for instance, you know, I think Ethiopian coffees here in Europe are a way bigger thing than in the States. It's not like it's not a thing, but like when I first started working with coffee, the most typical European blend that I saw was Brazil and Ethiopia. And I think the most typical US blend was Brazil and Colombia. And if you think about supply chains, that makes a lot of sense too. You know, you've got the biggest country in the world producing coffee, Arabicas, and the one of the next biggest, it's like Colombia. Well, that's quite close to the States and has great, you know, connections there. And Ethiopia is quite close to Europe.
So it's about those, proximity.
I think so. I mean, more, it makes a lot of sense.
More like, about proximity than taste preference.
Taste preference. Well, this is a whole thing, like with regards to taste preference, it's like a chicken and an egg thing, right? Mm. People like Brazilian coffees. But do people like Brazilian coffees because most coffee we drink is Brazilian? Or do we like Brazilian coffee and therefore there's a lot of Brazilian coffee? It's a chicken and an egg situation. We don't actually know that if the largest producing country in the world for the last 100 years was Indonesia, which is a very different flavor profile than Brazil as a generalization. Would we all love Indonesian coffees as first and say, ah, these Brazils, they're a little bit chocolatey and nutty, and I want more slightly vegetal notes, or like I want this, you know, because what you're used to also defines what you think is normal and what you think is therefore tasty. And I think we don't stop to think about that enough. Like, we assume that we're driving what we like, but that's not always the case. What is available also drives what we like.
And you think this is going to change?
Yeah.
And if we look at, well, geopolitics, if we look at supply chains, regulations, how will coffee taste like in Europe and North America in the next 10 years?
Yeah. I think if the tariffs stay the same, I guess we would see like, yeah, it's like a really specific thing, but in like the US, the tariffs for Brazil are quite low. It's on the 10% barrier. Vietnam, I think, is 46%. Vietnam is the world's biggest producer, Robusta, Conilon. Brazil is the second. So if you're sat in a chair and you produce instant coffee and you need good Robusta or bad Robusta, whatever you need, if one has a price differential of 30%+ more, then you shift your demand somewhere else. And so like that's a very tangible, specific example of how I think Conilon and Brazilian Conilon could be a way bigger thing in the US for instant products and therefore for a lot of coffee consumption or for traditional espresso roasts, things like that. I think how do we expect it to taste? I don't know. The funny thing that people don't really necessarily realize is that, you know, we talk about the third wave and we talk about Starbucks and like the popularization of coffee and these roasters, Pete's at Starbucks, people like that, they roast quite dark. They always roasted quite dark. We assume that's a bad thing. But actually, this was during a time where a lot of people historically were roasting quite light. I think there was even James Hoffman like video of him drinking some espresso from the 1950s or something. It was like a can of coffee. You could find it online. And he comments immediately like, oh, the roast is quite light. And actually, you know, so when you roast coffee, you lose moisture, you lose weight. So the darker you roast, the more weight you lose. Therefore, dark roast is kind of the more expensive way to produce coffee than light roast. But of course, light roast showcases the flavor profile of coffee better. Let's say the terroir or whatever you want to call it. So if you have a bad coffee and it's roasted light, it will taste worse than a good coffee that's roasted light. If you have a bad coffee that's roasted dark, it will probably cover up some of the odd flavors or whatever it is that makes it less pleasant. So you go back far enough, dark roast was a sign of quality because there was a lot of bad coffee that was lightly roasted to keep the weight high, to keep the value high for the existing product. So if prices keep going up and people being high, there's going to be a market incentive by people in the industries to roast lighter, actually, to keep because if we're talking about 100 tons of coffee or something, a 3% difference in weight loss is a huge amount of coffee. And so actually, I think we could see flavor profiles like roast become lighter and coffee in general become less tasty. Also, to connect back to the thing we were talking about earlier, like if prices are higher for producers and there's less incentive for them to produce good quality.
Yeah, but let's stick to the roasting. Yeah. That's an interesting perspective. I never thought about this. I mean, what I thought for Europe, what is going to happen is that Vietnam has been attributed more than 46% tariffs.
Yeah, to the US. Oh, yeah, yeah,
a lot. I mean, Vietnam has, historically been exporting a lot of coffee to Europe.
Yeah.
But now, as the Robusta Conilon needs for the US will be covered by Brazil mostly. I mean, where does this Robusta goes? So it must be cheaper again, and I guess it will come to Europe. I expect to drink more Robusta driven blends in the coming years, and yeah, maybe lighter roasts, light Robusta roasts from Vietnam. That might be the future for Europe.
As much as I have had some nice Robustas and offer some as well through my work, the idea of lightly roasted cheap Vietnamese Robusta doesn't fill me with a lot of joy.
Esosito, you're working with producers well long term, and you've been working with them for years. Now, all this situation, what does it cause on your own supply chains? And you said it quite right. I mean, it's a supply chain is made of people that take decisions and move goods.
Yeah.
Does all this affect your partnerships as well with producers?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of where the rubber meets the road, right? You kind of say, because if the market's bad, it's low price, and you say, hey, your coffee's great, we're going to pay you double the market price, and everyone's happy, and we walk away. And we can sell that for a good price. Yeah, it's fantastic. But then if you say, okay, we've had a bad year, the harvest hasn't been good, and the price is three times what it was, it's like, you know, do we do this or not? We want to do this. We want to keep working with the same producers. We have to have roasters as well who understand what's going on. That's also kind of why we have such frank communication through Instagram and other things. The roasters need to understand where we are at, so that when we come around and say, look, quality's down, price is up, are you still in? They don't think, okay, Stuart's trying to do something weird here. Like, what is he trying to do? Like, why is he doing this to me? They think, okay, I understand. Like, the market has changed. It might be better next year. Let's stick around and let's make this work for another year. And, for us, I don't think a lot has changed. And the really exciting thing for us is that we Yes, prices are up across the board, but for certain origins, prices are up less than they probably should be because we're paying good prices for years already. So we see a willingness to not give us a discount or something, but like there's less opportunistic kind of business making and more, okay, well, you're going to be here next year and the year after. So, you know, let's not put the prices up so high that Osito, and this would apply for other imports as well, have to walk away from the table. Like the prices are so high, we have to say no, which can, of course, happen. And so that's been really cool to see, you know, people trying to stick with us and go the distance. I think, like I mentioned in passing earlier, the 80 to 84 territory of coffees, which we always did less of anyway, were quite like high-end specialty importer. But those coffees, that's getting harder to source because I think a lot of those people, a lot of producers who were producing those coffees were maybe not as incentivized by quality as they were by prices, and that they don't have that incentive anymore. And what's more, even, you know, say you had a farm with 100, which produces 100 bags and 30 bags of micro lots. Maybe you still deliver those 30 bags of micro lots, but the 70 bag you used to bring for the regional blend, but now it's not worth the fuss. Like, let's not dry this properly to get it up to an 84. Let's just dry it and get it out the door. So I see, yeah, and I talked to a lot of roasters about this. Like, I see that being a really interesting development and a reality that I think there's a very real chance that we're about to enter another period of high prices, but not on the market level, not on the quality level, but on the specialty level. Because as all of these coffees are disappearing, and as producers are less incentivized to produce quality because the prices are just good for everything, there will be less specialty coffee. But demand for specialty coffee is really high. You know, we mentioned in passing new markets as well. Asia, Middle East, it's really growing. And these people, a lot of these consumers love coffee and they're willing to pay for it. So more demand, even less supply for a very specific kind of coffee naturally means prices will go up. And I do really see a world where really nice micro lots, specialty coffees, 86 plus, might be, you know, double the price of the commodity market, just like across the board, because there won't be so much of it going around and there will be more buyers. Yeah, I know, you know, we have some really frank conversations in the team about, you know, what it looks like if we have to enter a period of degrowth, you know, not that we're particularly growth minded or like business, but like, you know, what happens if we do less volume and just because the only stuff left for us is the really top quality and there's less of it, you know? And so then maybe our margins have to go up a little bit because if you're doing less volume, but covering the same number of team members or staffing, you know, but that's all speculative. I have no idea what will happen. And to be honest, if people actually looked at our margins, they'd be quite surprised how thin they are. But yeah, I do think it's been a fun time to work with the same people. It's been a nice experience to see people consistently come back to the table and be gracious and kind and be interested in what we're doing still. But I do think we're in a period of contraction with regards to availability for specialty coffee in general, not for Osito's coffees, for specialty coffee. So it's an interesting time.
Yeah, interesting is a good word. You know, I guess for all of us and for us too as well, the past 6-7 months, they have been determined from outside conditions. And I had other plans. I definitely had other plans. But now here we are. And you said, well, it's been good. Yeah, let's see where this is going. And degrowth, I mean, talking actively and discussing it realistically, what could happen? Well, that's something we do too. I mean, because we roast a bit less this year, and I talk to other roasters in Switzerland and Germany, and some of them are roasting less. And for some markets, we roast more, but there's a shift to cheaper coffees, and the cheaper coffees are not as cheap as they used to be. Yeah. And so we stick longer with more expensive coffees, more the 86 points plus coffees.
Yeah.
That's a development. So we are ordering less of 86 plus points coffees so that we do not sit too long on them. So for the new coffee world order, there's also a shift to local consumption. Because you say, hey, well, best coffees in the world will be consumed in the coffee land itself. And yeah. I said, yeah, I see this. I've been to, well, I lost part of me in Mexico. And every time I'm in Mexico, I go to fancy coffee shops. And even some just good coffee shops, they have spectacular coffees. Yeah. Because there's availability. And many of the good coffees stay there. Why do you think?
Yeah.
What are the reasons? Main reasons?
Yeah. I do want to mention before we get on this question, like for roasters out there, like the one good thing is like more people are drinking and spending money on coffee than ever before, you know? And so the era for expensive coffees to be expensive and be accepted is better than it's been, you know, 5 years ago, 2 years ago, 10 years ago, for sure. And I think that also applies to the question you just asked. You know, I said the best coffees in the world will be drunk where they're produced. I think that's true. And I think that's because we see this exact same trend of wanting the best coffees, even in countries where they produce coffee. I mean, historically, it's kind of a horrible, like tragic reality that people who've traveled to coffee farms and to coffee producing countries are often shocked by the low quality of coffee they're faced, you know,
coffee
with
a farm with sugar.
Yeah. The sugar, yeah. And this is in no way to disparage the, you know, coffee producers, but historically the way it worked was your best coffees, you export them, you sell them, you get them out the door. Yeah. So what are you drinking? You know, you're drinking the leftovers often. At best, you're drinking your lower quality stuff, but a lot of people, I mean, I go to Espirito Santo a few times. I go most years. This is a place in Brazil, fantastic coffees sometimes. Most of the coffee is pretty bad, actually. And that's what it's been known for, actually. It's kind of known for low quality. And then 20 years ago, people started to discover that if you use specific varieties and took the time, you would get exceptional quality. And you still see it there. Really interesting. You can have an 87, 88 point coffee that doesn't taste very different flavor profile than the rest of Brazil. Like way more floral, sweet, whatever. And on these farms, yeah, people are drinking low quality coffee. And anyway, that's the background. That's how it's almost always been. But if you think about the wine comparison, which I know we always bang on about with coffee and wine, but you know, I like to think the best French wine producers, German wine producers, Californian, whatever, hold a couple of bottles of the really good stuff for themselves, and they're saving it for a good occasion. And they know when they have a particular harvest, and this particular plot is going to be great. And they, you know, they know, and they, you know, they also want to put it aside. They're passionate about wine, and I think that's happening more with coffee. And I think producers are starting to see the value of their products more and enjoy them more. There's more understanding of cupping and quality management and these kind of things. And likewise, money is just flowing more around the world. You know, you go to Bogota and there's amazing coffee shops. You go to Sao Paulo and there's amazing coffee shops. You know, it's happening everywhere. And there are wealthy people in every country of the world, and those people want to buy high quality products and want to showcase to their friends, to their family, to their business connections the best of what their country is doing, and coffee is naturally part of that for a lot of these people. And I think that's what's going to be happening. I think that these cafes that are local are going to be buying good coffee, and they're going to be buying it locally. I mean, Brazil, we only talked about this last time. This is the one that really stands out to me. So Brazil has effectively an import ban on all foreign coffee. I mean, it just has this really, really high tariff. I mean, it's punitive, and it's supposed to be, because they don't want other countries sending their coffee there to undercut local production. And this is the case in Indonesia and lots of places around the world. So a roaster in Sao Paulo, like Coffee Lab, they've been there forever, doing great stuff. They're buying just Brazil. But, you know, how many profiles can you get from one country? Yes, you can get more than one. Yes, you could get a few. But if you want to get real variety, you're going to have to go out of your way and look for it. You're going to have to be willing to pay for it. But at the end of the day, if a local roaster comes, drives down the road to your farm, meets you, shakes your hand, you like each other, you do some business, they pay you cash in hand, they walk away with your best lots, you're thrilled. You're going to see them 3 months from now, 6 months from now. You're going to be able to talk in your own native tongue. You're going to be able to potentially avoid paperwork, phytosanitary certificates, this and the other. There's just so many advantages to selling to the guy down the road or the woman down the road or whatever you want to say, that I think the local roasters that are, you know, probably focused on tourists, they're focused on the wealthy people in big cities in those countries, they're going to be buying these great, like, Mexican coffees, Brazilian coffees, whatever it is. And those coffees are never going to see the market. They're not going to come to people like Osito. They're not going to come to roasters so readily. That's my prediction.
There's a much better relational story. So 2 years ago, I've been to Brazil, and I've been visiting a producer I've known for 7-8 years. Been on his farm, he's quite a known, respected specialty producer. And then we had a cupping. And while we were cupping, he said, I just want to mention that you could only buy the last 3 cups because the other 17, they were already bought in the sold in the local market.
Wow.
I said, yeah, good. Well, thank you for the cupping and let's finish this. But actually, I would have loved to choose another coffee, not one of the last three, but that was the reality. And yeah. Why should I wait for 6 months of payment day if I could just sell it now? And then I drive 2 hours and I visit the roaster and the coffee shop and I tell my own story. I mean, I live in that place. I'm from Switzerland. I live in a place where there's many people find pride in serving local products and creating food networks and showing it, you know, like regional products and doing exactly the same thing, not on coffee, but maybe on cheese, or I know hazelnuts is a big thing in Switzerland these days. So I was like, hey, there's a producer I've known in that village. It creates so much proximity, even though if you're from here, it makes you much more feel connected to the place where you're from. So it's exactly the same what's happening with coffee in other places.
And I mean, we're seeing this. You mentioned Mexico. I've mentioned India earlier in the conversation. These two origins, I'm very much seeing this happening more than it was already happening a year ago. It was already happening 3 years ago, but it's happening way more now. And the big thing is these were places where specifically Brazilian coffee was imported to serve the local market.
Hmm.
Cheap Brazilian coffee was coming into India, was coming into Mexico. So there was a lot of coffee being imported from Brazil, cheap coffees, and this would go into whatever cheaper blends and I don't know, but it would be widely consumed instead of Indian coffees, instead of Mexican coffees that would then be sold at a higher price. It sounds totally crazy to us. But of course, if I can sell my coffee for 10 euro per kilo and I can buy other coffee for 5 euro, it's also okay. Then there's a natural like differential there that you can make money and whatever. But now coffee is generally quite expensive. And in fact, coffee from Brazil is specifically quite expensive. We see Mexican roasters, not necessarily the really high-end ones you were talking about, but just a lot of Mexican roasters. We see Indian roasters saying, why would I buy Brazilian coffee at this price when I can work with a large estate here and buy at the same price, if not maybe I pay a little bit more, but I save money on logistics, I save money on paperwork, I save money on transport, whatever. I can buy local and then I can market that as like, we have a great Mexican coffee, we're a Mexican roaster, Mexican focused, we're a great Indian roaster, we have Indian coffees, blah, 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 blah. And so then you have a funny thing where you have a European buyer looking at a spot sheet and they're saying, or looking at coffees coming, and they're like, okay, so Brazil is way more expensive, so maybe I'll buy Indian coffees because the profile is also quite chocolatey and we can use that instead. Oh, it's also even more expensive. Okay. Maybe we could do a Mexico. Mexico is also quite chocolatey, quite, you know, balanced. It's also even more expensive. And it's because there's people in those countries willing to pay the same, if not more. Yeah. And we've had some really interesting situations where, you know, we're selling coffees. There are buyers on the local market who are willing to spend more than international buyers on these coffees. So that's it's already happening, and not just for the higher end stuff, but yeah, it's happening.
So why would an Indian exporter export coffee?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think sometimes I don't know. We work with some really exceptional people in India. Like, I've had the pleasure to meet multiple of them, not everyone, but, and just really smart, really engaged, really passionate coffee professionals. Sometimes I do think, if you could get this price locally, why would you, you know, get the same price but sell it internationally? Yeah. Or maybe in some instances a worse price for specific lots, like that we feel, or the end roaster feels, they cannot sell at the price that's being asked. Which I would say is the exception, not the rule, just to be clear. But like, I think there is an acknowledgement that the status quo, there's no assurance that the status quo will be the status quo 12 months from now. So, you know, if I say today I'm going to sell all my coffee to Philip because he's willing to pay a good price, and I'll burn all the bridges I have with all the other roasters that I work with, and they're all very upset with me. And then next year, Philip decides, I need to diversify. I can't just buy all my coffee from Stuart. I can't buy all his coffee again. And you buy it from a few different people. And then I have coffee suddenly, and I have to go back. You have to crawl back to the roasters and say, could you please work with me again? Like, there's a bit more long-term thinking there. I think the reason to work internationally when there are good local buyers who are willing to pay good prices is hedging your bet. You're taking the chance that the market will move against you, that the local market won't stay high, that some of those buyers might be fickle. They're only around this season because Brazil's expensive. But next year you could get a good price again from that roaster in Australia or Europe or the US or whatever it is. And that is pretty smart. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, one more thing to India. I mean, all what you said doesn't only apply to Arabica, but also to Robusta.
Robusta, 100%.
Well, washed Robustas, AB and bigger screens, parchment, as they call it, washed coffees in India, has been traditionally, especially in Switzerland and mostly Germany, heavy used coffee. Because it was the softer version of the wet polished Vietnam Robustas.
Yeah.
They still are great. And we've been buying those coffees as well. And these coffees, they have doubled in price.
Yeah.
At least. And this came as a shock for many, me included. Well, I knew what's going to happen, but still seeing it on paper, seeing the brut number is a different thing. And it's interesting that, I mean, it applies to all coffee, not only Arabicas or, let's say, exceptional coffees. No, to coffee in general, because he said, poof, I don't have to import coffee any longer from somewhere else. So let's cut down on logistics. Just use it here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just last few days made an agreement with a producer we're working with. He needed us did you a bit of a favor and we took some coffees, some Robustas. They're going to be great. Like really the top end of Indian Robusta production. But because we were doing him a bit of a favor, he was willing to offer us a little bit of a discount. Mm-hmm. And we're fully traceable, transparent, kind of importer, exporter. So, you know, I'm happy to say like we're going to pay $3.80 per pound on this Robusta. And that was a big discount. Like that was a big discount. And that is a kind of figure, you know, for listeners of yours who don't maybe have all of this to hand, like that's how much you would have paid a few years ago for a high quality Colombian Michelob, you know. It is, and you know, we're talking maybe an 80 point fine, good quality Robusta. And it's really interesting. I wonder how this will stay or change over time, but I'm not seeing the differentials for Robusta that, you know, the difference between the Arabica and the Robusta price is getting smaller. Yeah. And in some instances, it's not there at all.
Is there something to round up? Is there something we are not going to see in the next 10 years? Because what we've been talking about, all the things we potentially are going to see, but what are we not going to see?
I don't think coffee is going away. Let me put it that way. There's a lot of doubt and debate about climate change and how much it's going to impact coffee or not. And I think it will and is already impacting coffee a lot. But I do not believe, you know, there's these doomsday, you know, 10 years from now, there will be X percentage less coffee produced. I do not believe this. I think through technological changes, through new varieties, things like that, I think we will keep production at similar levels, maybe higher. I do not necessarily think production will go massively up ever again. I don't know. I can't see how. I also don't think, I mean, I'm super excited about different species of coffee. You know, your Excelsas, your Racemosas, your, you know, Libericas, these kind of things. They're very interesting and I'm very interested in them. But I do not see them taking a significant part of a market share within the coming, you know, 10 years. To use a rather bizarre, but I think apt comparison. I used to travel in China as a tourist and to visit. I study the language, and I have never eaten dog. I have never eaten rat, and I don't think you see those things very often. But I did eat types of meat you don't normally see in Europe. You know, snake. I've eaten turtle. I've eaten these things, and the thing I discovered was most of these odd types of meat you've never really get. The reason they're not popular is because they're not that good. They're not as, you put them next to a good piece of beef, you put them next to a good piece of chicken, whatever it is, it's not as good. And I think Excelsas, these other things, they're very interesting. The flavor profiles are very different. But I think in reality, they're going to be too hard to produce, too complicated to produce. And the profiles are too different to what we used to. So I also do not predict that we are sat here in 10 years drinking lots of cups of whatever it is. Maybe we haven't even heard of it yet. I think the interest in those things will keep growing, and I think they will be more present in the market, especially the specialty market, than they are now. But I also think that it won't be such a big thing as some people maybe predict.
If Stuart ever decides to write a book, I'll be the first to support him. He brought up some important points in this conversation, points that may hurt a little, but they are pragmatic. We talked about degrowth, we talked about the big what if questions, and maybe that's exactly what coffee businesses need right now. Not to bury our hands in the sand, not to just do things the same old way. Times are definitely challenging, and maybe it's not about reinventing your entire business model, but it is about being brutally honest with yourself.
Where do you want to invest your energy next? Coffee businesses are not alone in this. But I feel that there is still not enough open talk about it. And that's why I wanted to have this conversation with Stuart. If you feel inspired to talk about your business and the challenges you have, talk about it. Invite others in, start a WhatsApp group, find new ways to cope with this new coffee world order. You're not alone in this. Thanks for listening, and hear you next time.